So, you are listening to KDVS 90.3. This is Professor J, otherwise known as Naomi Janowitz. And before we begin, I want to remind you that the views presented in this hour may not reflect the views of KDVS or the KDVS sponsors or the University of California. So, as you are no doubt aware, today is drive day. So while we feed your mind, which we're going to start with in just a minute, feed the station so we can spend the show feeding your mind. So somewhere along the way, we're hoping you're going to call 530-754-KDVS, that famous repetition over and over again of the phone number, 754, that's 5387, 754-KDVS. We have a matching grant of $100. So the first $100 we raise today will be matched 2-for-1, and we know listeners love matches out there. So make double your dollars today for office hour. And we will remind you again. But in the meantime, we're going to switch gears and, as always, do what we do at 5 o'clock on Tuesday. We're going to go knock on a door. And here we're knocking on a door, and we're saying, what are all these people doing in these buildings here on the public affairs here at KDVS? We take you inside people's offices in office hours to find out what they're thinking about. What are they studying? What intrigues them? What new ideas have they come up with? So, and as always, I'm very excited today to knock on a new door. This is in the Department of Spanish and Portuguese, the door of John Slater. So welcome, John, to office hour.
Well, thank you very much. It's nice to be here.
Right. So John is going to be telling us some really interesting ideas about what we think of as being both the history of science and, in my mind, the history of humanities as well in Spain in the early modern period. But as always, before we jump into the particular projects that he's been working on recently and the articles he's written, we always start with the same question, which is, how does someone end up where they end up as a professor at UC Davis, in this case in the Department of Spanish and Portuguese, writing about 17th century Spain? It seems like maybe not the most obvious thing to do unless you have a... So what story led you to your particular area of research, John?
Well, I was always a fan of reading novels, and I thought that I was going to specialize in 19th century Spanish novels when I was in graduate school, and I was preparing for my qualifying exams, and I had to read lots of things from the medieval period through the Renaissance and the Baroque, and I got to the 17th century, and I didn't really understand a lot of the literature I was reading, and particularly religious literature. And when I began reading a kind of dramatic spectacle that was a Eucharistic allegory, a one-act play that was performed in the streets and written by some of the greatest playwrights of the time, I thought, I do not understand these plays as drama very well at all. I mean, these seem sort of strange to me and peculiar, and that's what really got me hooked, was the feeling that there was something about a period, the period of Cervantes and the period of when we think about the novel beginning, that was supposed to be comprehensible to me. And as it turned out, there were lots of things that I didn't understand, and mm-hmm. it was that wanting to understand things and especially things having to do with the popular instruction of theological ideas and what the Eucharist was and what it meant to take communion and what it meant to sort of build a community around religious rituals that really started to fascinate me.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying that you were found something. You were already studying. So you already were in a PhD program. So you're already committed to working in something in terms of the history at this period, or the literature, you said you came in through literature, and you stumbled upon something that was both, it sounds, familiar and unfamiliar.
That's exactly right. Yeah. I mean, I got to graduate school because I misspent a great deal of my undergraduate career. And my senior year, I just really started to love reading Spanish literature. And I went to one of my professors and I said, what do I do? I'm running out of time here and I'm just enjoying this so much. And she said, well, you can go to graduate school, and which had never occurred to me. And so I went to graduate school.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so notice the listeners, notice the term here. He misspent many years. We won't go into detail how exactly you misspent
it. Thank you.
Sometimes it's stories of pre-med or other kinds of things. But for you, when you were a senior, you found something you loved.
Yes.
You found literature. And it turns out, just to let everybody know, that if you find something you love when you're a senior, that doesn't have to be the end of it.
Right, exactly. And so here I am years later, and I get to share the things that I really enjoy and then think about with my students.
And you still enjoy them.
I still enjoy
them. So I think that's an important point to make as well. There was something about something that happened to you in your senior year that something solidified that became a long-term interest.
That's exactly right. Right,
exactly. Yeah. So that's pretty exciting. Now, the particular things that you studied are texts that I can pretty much guarantee none of our listeners have ever read any of. It's not like you're reading, working with standard literature that people would have stumbled over. The first article we're going to be talking about of yours has got the extremely intriguing title, Alchemical Sermons in Spain, 1675 to 1708. So if for those of us who have never heard before about an alchemical sermon, which is a really interesting connection of two things we don't usually think about, putting it together, the idea of alchemy, which we associate generally as a historian of science, and then a sermon, which we associate much more with religion. So we'll unpack this. But why don't you start off by telling us, when you use the word alchemical, what do you mean by that? That's a term that's used in different ways.
Yeah. So around 1675, where we are at the end of the period when alchemy is a secret practice of trying to transmute metals and trying to perfect the self through working with materials. And the ultimate quest is for eternal life. Usually the philosopher's stone was really a signpost on the way of the great work of the alchemist, that the alchemist was discovering the ways in which the universe really worked and was discovering the principles of elements, and that power would allow the alchemist, usually a man, but not always, to sort of transcend the limits that nature seemed to impose on human beings. And so as that period starts to end and people become more engaged with things that aren't secret, laboratory design and the production of strong acids and alkalis, that we start to see what is almost chemistry, the sort of in the sense that things can be measured and repeated and disseminated and reproduced in other areas, but still carrying with it some ideas about maybe they're on the verge of discovering a kind of universal solvent that would dissolve all the obstructions in the body and lead to health in all people and for all diseases. So a kind of a dream of a panacea or another sort of really powerful medicine. So there's this period when alchemy stops being about secrets, stops being a kind of a language, a coded language of, you know, lions and mothers and sons and becomes, you know, they're talking about vitriol and tartar and things that we would recognize. But it still hasn't sort of become what we would recognize as a modern science. It remains some of the sort of esoteric legacy that it has from alchemy, but is sort of more public. I guess that's the main difference.
Well, that's an interesting transition for us to think about. In other words, the idea of alchemy goes way back before the 17th century in Spain. Exactly as you said, the idea of some way find eternal life, some way to transmute metals from one form to another, some things that philosopher's stone, people may be more familiar with that since it made its way into Harry Potter.
Right.
but that what's happening in society is that there are times where the social placement of an idea moves from one part of the social system to another part of the social system. So what's happening, something that might have been only a small number of people who huddled together in secret and said, don't say anything about this. This is now moving out into society, and more people are interested in alchemical ideas.
Yeah.
And it's so now it becomes something that lots of people are going to try to openly build and investigate. You may need a laboratory now. You don't have to hide it.
Right.
It's part of the social fabric that's out there.
And there begin to be things like commercial networks for crucibles. And we know that if you wanted to heat up something really, really hot to assay a metal, for example, you would need a very special ceramic vessel in which to do that. We know that there were commercial networks that extended all across Europe to sell. There were really two leading manufacturers of these crucibles. And the other thing is that you mentioned Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone as a way that we think about alchemy, but alchemy's sort of medical applications beginning really in the 16th century had a lot to do with distillation.
Right.
And so through distillation, you would distill the wine in the wine or the grain in the grain. And what they were really doing is making what we would call brandy and what we today call whiskey. You know, brandy is sort of distilled wine and whiskey is distilled beer.
But that's alchemy.
But that's alchemy because, and we still call them spirits.
Right.
Because it's the spirit of the grape and it's the spirit of the grain.
How did it happen then that something that was a secret tradition stopped being secret and became part of sort of standard mercantile life as well as more standard healing practices?
Well, I think, you know, this is one of the big questions that we have. One of the reasons is that there was a lot of dissatisfaction with medical practice as people saw, really, you know, medicine doesn't have a lot to offer us when it comes to epidemic disease. Medicine doesn't have a lot to offer us in terms of facing really difficult diseases. It always helps to talk to someone who is an expert in human experience. And that was a lot of what physicians offered people, was a kind of way, a guide through the experience of disease.
Sort of moral philosophy.
Right, yeah.
But that was not a lot of help if you also wanted a cure.
And it was also not a lot of help if the doctor or physician prescribed you cauterization, for example, which was horrifically painful. You know, I mean, they would say, well, you know, you've got some bad humors in you, and we would like to apply this really, really hot iron right below your knee, you know, and then it would sort of bubble up and it would weep for days. And they would say, see all that bad stuff that you had inside
you
that
were
now,
better?
Don't you feel better? Well, people really got upset about the fact that that they were being cauterized, that people did not want that. And the other thing that people didn't like is there are a lot of medical debates about, you know, what do you do with a wound?
Mm.
Before germ theory, you know, wounds were really, really dangerous. And so, you know, some physicians would say, you got to keep that thing open, you know, and so they would maintain the wound open.
Okay, listeners, I didn't know we were going to get into so many gruesome. Basically, if you went to the doctor in the 16th century, he would torture you.
It was painful and expensive, right? And then he would ask for money afterwards.
And then you probably die anyway.
Right, yeah. So when other kinds of practitioners came along and said, you know what, I have distilled something that I am calling, you know, spirit of cinnamon.
Spirit of cinnamon, that sounds very good.
Right, just schnapps or something like that, right? Drink this, and you know, people said, wow, I feel fantastic. And so we start to see in Spain and lots of other places in Europe, handbills, advertisements that start to circulate that say, I have discovered the great recipe of, gold that you can drink, potable gold, and it's delicious and it harms no one and it's safe for kids and it cures scrofula and cancer and colicky babies and all sorts of things. And so people were really taken with that. And they were also, I mean, I think just as today, taken with the idea that there are other ways of treatment, other forms of medicine that their doctor won't tell them about.
Alternative medicine,
mm-hmm, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So when we find it, maybe your point you're making for us today is that we shouldn't be surprised that alchemy is part of the religious tradition as well, and it shows up in sermons.
Right.
So let's just quickly go over. You mentioned alchemy shows up in, now we've got it in the mercantile business because mm-hmm. you're making alcohol, spirits. It shows up in religious circumstances. It shows up in, you might even think in terms of more secular
right.
kinds of. So in other words, it's sort of a model that's used across all through different parts of society. So what is the role of these traditions within religion? I mean, in some ways, healing makes more sense to mm-hmm. us than how does alchemy going to help religion?
Right. When you went to university, for example, in 1600, there were only a couple of things you could study. And one of those things was law. And the other thing was medicine. And law was divided into civil law and canon law or religious law. And there was always a lot of tension and rivalry among these essentially different professions. Those who practiced ecclesiastical law and those who practiced medicine, for example, they were always at each other's throats. So there's a long history of the idea that physicians should stick to healing the body and that religious figures, priests and friars should stick to healing the soul. They didn't always respect those divisions.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things that you start to see is because many of these religious orders, Benedictines very famously, were known for distilling, for making Benedictine and chartreuse and some of these other mm-hmm. Herbal remedies that we're familiar with today. They had distributed those mostly to the poor, and they started to see that there was a market for them. And so they start to say, well, you know what, we have always made people come into the cloister of the convent in order to buy these medicines that
now
we have.
Now we're going to sell it on the street.
And now we're going to make, we're going to make a little shop.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the great things about religious orders is they always had great real estate. You know, in a lot of European cities now.
So you have a good
now,
shop. You said it's crazy that we aren't selling our schnapps on the front
and
street.
It's crazy that we're only selling it at cost.
Mm.
Why don't we just talk to the king, tell him how much money we really need, all the good work we're doing. We're mostly treating the poor. Mm. Would it be so bad if we kept a little bit more because we would really like to have a bunch of new paintings for our altar?
Mm-hmm. Well, in some ways, it shouldn't be surprising that within the religious orders, they saw healing as part of their job.
Right.
There would be no reason why they would think that this is for this other group called doctors. Healing is definitely, if you think of it historically, part of a religious endeavor anyway. You know, I also got the idea that alchemy supplied for them certain theoretical models of
right.
how the world works that they could use theologically as well.
That's exactly right. So, you know, during the 16th century, so if you heard some religious figure talking about alchemy in 1550, they would probably say, there's fake alchemy and then there's real alchemy. Fake alchemy is what alchemists try to do. Real alchemy, a kind of spiritual transformation, is what Christ does.
And only Christ.
Really, a century later, they start to say, no, these are actually analogs for one another. These are related ways of understanding spiritual transformation. And so we work with the material world and we work with alchemical processes and early chemical processes in order to understand through the natural world and through science what happens to human beings as they experience salvation. And so that's really a big change in the church. It doesn't go away altogether. For example, Jesuits are very Aristotelian. They have a model that they teach a lot of Aristotle. They have a very sort of an academy model that really goes back to, they think, to the sort of 5th century BC. So other religious orders start to say, well, don't be like the Jesuits. The inventor of alchemy was actually a biblical figure. It was Noah's father or Noah's son, or maybe it was Moses, because there's a story about Moses. Moses comes down from Mount Sinai with the tablets, and he sees what have the Israelites done. They have taken all their gold, and they have made an idol, a golden calf. And so in the Bible, it says that Moses takes the calf, and he pounds it into a powder, and he sprinkles the powder, this golden powder, over the water, and he makes the Israelites drink the water. And so in the 17th century, they say, Moses was the first alchemist. Mm. He's making this soluble gold. He's making this drinkable gold.
Well, it's quite a misreading of the story in a lot of ways. I don't think he did it for their good.
Right, yeah.
Exactly.
Well, you know, I mean.
But I understand. In other words, there's many ways in which you can find in the Hebrew scriptures a lot of references that make the alchemical traditions make sense and also fit in old traditions and see them as part of the ancient legacy that comes from the wisdom of the ancient Israelites.
That's exactly right. And that's not just a Christian tendency, that it's this is very alive among Jewish religious leaders, especially during the 16th and 17th century, to look back at the Old Testament in particular and to think about fire and gold and salt and spiritual transformation, and the rising of Elijah and Elisha and the sort of and as sort of sublimation of material and a spiritual process and a material process. So it's not limited to Christians.
That's right. Jews were definitely doing the same things.
And alchemy is a word that comes from Arabic. So, I mean, it's really, there are lots of religious traditions that are interested in heating substances, trying to understand through the application of heat what the elemental nature of natural substances might be.
I think about this sometimes because I have students who are very excited for a while, though I haven't heard this much recently, that certain things like the word for penicillin is hidden in the Bible.
Mm.
And I'm curious what you think about this sort of as a social construct in which religion gains a certain kind of power because it prefigures science. In other words, who cares in your religious tradition if the word for penicillin is in the Bible or not? But for them, I think it's important simply today because science has so much prestige.
Right.
That you want to be able to hook religion onto the prestige of science. And that makes religion seem, we anticipated even before scientists did. Do you think that same dynamic, it might be very anachronistic, so I'm ready to be corrected, but do you think that same dynamic worked back there in the 17th century, that this was a way of propagating theological doctrines because they seem very up-to-date and supported by the most current scientific visions?
You really start to see that in the 17th century a lot. So you'll read arguments such as this one. We know that in order to exert a force, you must have mass. And we know that God exerts forces, therefore God must have mass. That this idea that everything needs to line up in a way that is perfect. And really, if you went back to the 1400s and said, is the literal truth of the Bible the most important thing about the Bible? They would generally say no, just as Christians, for the most part, thought the most important things about the Old Testament were that it prefigures the New Testament. Mm-hmm. They would say, you know, this is it's a kind of a roadmap for history and a roadmap for living a life. Its literal importance is not that big a deal. That really starts to change after the Reformation. And so you see a lot more people who are searching for these kinds of literal explanations for what they are seeing in their lives. They want to see it exactly in the Bible. Mm-hmm. And so you see a really big growth during the 17th century of gematria and Kabbalistic sort of reasoning. Can I transliterate the Vulgate Bible into Hebrew letters and then add them up and come up with 888? And you know, those kinds of games become really important because people want to believe that all the things that they're learning about the natural world are in perfect consilience with what they read in the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a pretty natural thing. And I think you're also right that that as science gains in prestige, those issues become increasingly important. People really need to feel that the most important thing in their lives, which may be their religious conviction, has the same kind of prestige that they see science have in other places. At the same time, I mean, I think you can also despair of the low prestige that science has in our society today, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can say,
mm-hmm.
Tons of people believe in a young earth. Tons of people reject all kinds of.
But not among the students who are looking for penicillin to be hidden in
right.
the Bible for
yeah.
those. But I think there's actually different ways in which society can go, that sometimes it goes to a different sphere, the idea that religion and science are two different spheres, mm-hmm. and then you don't really care as much. But you don't see this in your material. In your material, you see, exactly as you say, a very strong interest in saying that our you know, religious figure is as up-to-date as anybody
right.
on how to understand the natural world. And he may even be better than a lot of other people at understanding the natural world, because it's all the same. What we do with your drink, what you do with your body, and how your soul works, and how the whole world works, are all the same model. If I can explain it to you so you can understand it.
And I think, you know, that's what most people would say the real object of science is, right? To bring observation into conversation with biblical exegesis, biblical interpretation. So how do I make a system out of all the things that I am able to know? Those things to me, I think that for most people in the 17th century would say, yeah, that's what science is. It's the whole picture.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, you can say science is an anachronism, but I mean, what people were really wanting from natural investigation, kind of the kinds of research that were going on, were big answers that made sense of lots of different things. And as you were sort of saying, that as somebody makes a discovery in mathematics, there must be an application to biblical scholarship. If someone discovers penicillin, that word can't just be a chance. It must have some meaning because penicillin is so important.
Mm-hmm. And my text is so important. My religious text is so important.
Right.
It can't be that it didn't recognize these kinds of things. In this development, which you're talking about, 15th and 16th and then 17th century, Was technology important in the changes at all? I often wonder whether or not sort of technological changes that happen in how we do science in the laboratory, sort of almost mundane issues in terms of how we work, end up having implications for sort of the way we think and imagine the world to be. I mean, we're always wondering what is sort of the causal factor of change, right?
Right, yeah.
So do we want to find it in the laboratory? I was quite struck by how many parts of your society are actually futzing with liquids
yeah.
and trying to actually do things. It's a very applied notion there, and,
right.
and one in which everybody's drinking the schnapps and seeing what you're getting out of this all. So is technology a driver in this, or do you think it was more that sort of intellectual ideas were changing the way people thought about or imagined aspects of the cosmology, which is changing?
I think that one of the things that particularly historians of the 16th century have said is that there is a growth of a culture of experimentation,
okay.
that people think of themselves increasingly as being experimenters.
Right.
And they think not just this is the recipe that my family has conserved for a really long time, but I wonder if I can improve this ink. That idea that you don't just do things the way that you've done them because they work, but that it's sort of everybody's obligation to sort of tinker and as you say, futz with things, that idea is growing, right? And so you have a lot more people saying to themselves, I wonder if the way that I grew up distilling things, because this distillation was also a domestic practice, I wonder if that can be improved. And I wonder if I got the right combination of things into my distillation vessel, my alembic. I wonder if I might be able to try something new or figure something out that hasn't been figured out before. And this idea that people felt as though they were on the verge of discovering something new was pretty widespread. And so what that meant is the sort of technical engagement, engagement with the laboratory equipment of late alchemy and early chemistry. We know that lots of people knew what the vessels looked like, knew what crucibles looked like and alembics and these kinds of things, knew what the particular furnaces looked like, and the plans for these things were really widely disseminated. So when religious figures are talking, for example, about distillation, they'll say, well, everybody knows that when the distillation starts, you start with a high heat and then lower the heat. And then the beginning of the distillation process will throw off an oil that you don't want, and you set that aside. And then they'll use that as a story of spiritual transformation. And the sermons tend to assume a really high degree of familiarity with those fairly technical processes of distillation.
As if someone's uncle. Just like your uncle,
exactly.
You know, if you've been over there recently visiting your family, your uncle was doing these things when he was trying to do something. And now I can incorporate that into my sermon because it gives me a way of explaining the world and explaining everything. I really want to emphasize this point because I think that you've really put your finger on something that's fascinating. You know, people ask me how come alchemical traditions lasted for so long and in some of the similarities of the way in which the endeavors were done. And to me, that's not the interesting question. The interesting question is not why people do what they did before, but why anybody ever does anything new.
Right.
I think that is a much deeper problematic to explain about humanity. So you're pointing out that this may have been a time in history when people were thinking about, instead of just repeating the way things were done, but we're actually experimenting with new ways of doing it.
There's another aspect to it, which is that distillation, for example, is moving out of the kitchen. It stops once it becomes more interesting to people who are interested in natural philosophy or science. Mm-hmm. Then it starts to become men's work, too. Right. It moves into the public sphere in a way in which it moves out of the kitchen and into the laboratory, because distillation was something that always happened at home.
Absolutely.
Imagine that. Where is the place where you have a low, constant fire over a long period of time? Right? It's in the kitchen. And so we know without any doubt at all that most distillation during the 1400s, 1500s was done in monasteries and in kitchens. And then in the 1600s, people start to, you know, as these sermons start to be published and as people start to think more positively about these processes of spiritual change and what we can know about volatilizing different substances at different temperatures, and people start to think about those things more, well, then as it becomes higher prestige and more highly theorized in books, then men start to say, yeah, we should be in charge of that.
Maybe there's something important going on here, and maybe we should take it away from the women.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Terrific. Well, we've reached the end of our first segment today, so we will be back with John Slater to talk some more about alchemy in early modern Spain. So stay with us while we listen to a couple of messages, and we will be right back. So welcome back to the second half of Office Hour today. I just want to remind everybody that this is our pledge week. And in order to be here and have this equipment, we need you to get on the phone or get online and give us some support. I want to thank Rick from Reading and Andrew from Davis who have donated. We have a $100 matching fund that is now in effect. And you can call 530-754-KDVS. That's 754-5387. You can also go online and make a donation so that we can keep this station going, so we can keep your mind working. So thanks to those who have donated, and we look forward to hearing from some more of you before the show ends today. So before we move on to one of John's other topics, John Slater here from Spanish and Portuguese, he wants to say a couple more things about the study of alchemy in Spain in the early modern period, which is what we were talking about in the first segment. So, John, what's on your mind?
Well, you began by saying that you thought the title of this article about alchemical sermons in Spain was interesting. And the other thing that I just wanted to mention is about sermons, because sermons are probably the literary genre that most people were familiar with. Yes. They have the highest degree of cultural penetration, really, that we can see of really any kind of. It's almost a dramatic genre. It's a kind of oratorical performance. And even today, it's the kind of oratory that most people in a country like the United States, in which there is a pretty high percentage of religious attendance, the kind of literary performance that most people are familiar with. And so one of the reasons that I started working with sermons is that they allow you to look at problems of scale in ways that other forms of literature don't. So lyric poetry, for example, extremely important for elite circles of people. but sermons are generally preached before popular audiences.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're kind of an interesting source for that reason. I just wanted to say that that the one of the reasons that I think for the history of alchemy and the history of science in general that sermons are interesting or important is that they give us an idea of what it sounded like when people were talking about science, what they heard in church, what they heard from the people that they thought were the most authoritative or that they respected the most. So I think that sermons are really overlooked as a source material for intellectual history and literary history. And I have learned, I should say also, my father was a Congregationalist minister. So I grew up very familiar with sermons, and these are very long. These are like 30 pagers. So people had
but
some stamina.
But they were actually delivered to that long sermon. Do you think that people deliver those long sermons?
I have seen manuscript copies that they that the preachers would say, you know, I preach this sermon in this particular church in this year, and yeah, they're pretty close to the published versions.
Right. Well, it's a fascinating point again because it shows up that the average person hearing these sermons, you say this is a very popular literature, would be exposed to very very contemporary ideas about.
Yeah.
Alchemy and science.
That's
in
exactly
that way.
Right.
So in that way, it's quite interesting that it's a way of diffusing ideas through society in a major way.
Right. And in a way that people associate with reliability and authority and I think when we do the history of science, we tend to focus on the work of scientists, not the mechanisms of diffusion. And I think that more people came into contact with ideas about what was happening in the world of science through things like sermons than they did through, a book published by Robert Boyle or Isaac Newton or somebody like that.
Mm-hmm. This is where science, this is like, I don't know, should we say this is like large undergraduate introduction to science classes?
That's exactly right, yeah.
Some of them probably feel that they go on very long sermons in their science classes.
Yes, and there were probably a lot of people who were paying about as much attention as we know our students do during large lectures. You know,
I'm wondering who's got the notes on that.
Right.
But every so often, somebody, they talk about the transmutation of something into gold, and everybody's ears would perk up, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, I want to move on to another paper of yours, because I think it also raises some interesting questions for us, thinking about sort of how we understand and write history retroactively. And this is an article called Being Beyond, The Black Legend and How We Got Over It. And I think just to give a little bit of context to this, I take it that the black legend is a sort of part of the history of science in a sort of an idea that some countries are more important than other countries when you write the history of science. And that you, as a historian of science, sort of inherit this black legend. It includes the specific idea that Spain was not terribly important in the history of science. And here you are then, having gone many years, trying to change that by saying, no, you're wrong, Spain is important.
Right. Yeah, it's an idea that is really explicitly a part of the French Enlightenment, that the idea that the history of science is a kind of a melodrama that has good guys and bad guys, and the bad guys are Spain, and a lot of the philosophers of the French Enlightenment ask, you know, what did Spain ever do for science?
What were they doing all those times?
Right.
Taking siestas.
Right, exactly. they were so busy taking siestas and killing people. And so that has really persisted since the middle of the 18th century, really up until today, the idea that there isn't a history of science to tell. There's a kind of a history of shame that takes the place of a history of science. And part of that is because we haven't valued social history of science. We haven't valued people's, the sort of broad engagement of regular people with processes of experimentation and collecting plants and learning about the natural world. We've really focused, for a long time on a small number of great figures.
But are you saying, I mean, we go back, the problem, the legacy, the first part is this problem with that Spain somehow doesn't have a role. Now, the next step would be to counter-argue and say that Spain really does have a role. But what is interesting to me that in this paper, you say that that's not worth it. It's not worth getting in the argument of trying to say Spain is important. So I think it would be interesting for listeners for you to clarify why it isn't worth from your point of view. I think the natural feeling of many of our listeners would be that if it turns out the French wrote the Spanish out of the history of science, what should the Spanish do? They should come in and write the French
right.
out of the history of science, or at least write the Spanish back into the history of science. But that, and ultimately, you don't find very satisfying. So I'm very curious about that.
Well, I don't think that the answer is to write the history of science without Descartes, for example. I don't think that the answer is to write the history of medicine without William Harvey and the circulation of the blood. I don't think that that there should be a kind of revenge narrative mm-hmm. in which there are new winners and losers. I do think that the history of science is frequently burdened with a particular kind of responsibility, which is to tell us how we got here and how great we are.
Mm-hmm.
Because science has a lot of prestige, and because we think it's important to know how Galileo suffered at the hands of the Inquisition on his way to bringing mm-hmm. a kind of Promethean mission to bring light to all of humankind. And those things are really important. At the same time, it leaves a lot of stuff out of history, and it leaves a lot out of people's experience of what they thought about the natural world and how they understood their place in it and what kinds of ideas they had about how does weather work? Where does rain come from?
Mm-hmm.
Why does salt taste the way that it does? Why, to really basic questions, what were human beings' experience of those things? That can also be part of a social history of science.
Mm-hmm.
And so I spent probably the first 10 years of my publishing career saying, yes, Spain ought to have a place in this narrative.
Booster.
Yeah, I really was. I said, we're missing out on really interesting stories. And other than long distance navigation, which people say is a kind of a technical achievement and not really a scientific achievement, we haven't been very willing to admit Spain into these stories, even when especially in the areas of botany or natural history and medicine, there are lots of things happening in Spain that are comparable to what's happening everywhere else.
So for a while, you did take the tack of being a Spain booster,
yeah.
saying that one of the things that we need to do is correct the history. Presumably, the French wrote their particular view of the history of science because they had their view of the history of science, and they were trying to advocate, as you say, and I think this is a very important point, they were trying to advocate for something about the current world and saying we are the ones that the current importance of science is because of us. So it is very much this, as we say, this genealogy
right.
of ideas. So one thing to do is to get in there and to try to duke it out with them and to have Spain be important retrospectively. The other way is to change the very definition of the endeavor you're doing
right.
to change the basis of what you're looking at. In your case, it would be, how could we describe that shift? On the one hand, you are looking much more broadly, that the history of science may include a lot of things that our listeners hadn't thought of as being the history of science. So you're broadening it that way. You're not trying to say Spain did it too, but you're saying the whole history of thinking about science, because here you are, you're going to look at sermons
right.
and you're going to learn a whole lot there. So some of it, can you talk about the ways in which you want to reshape the idea of the history of science?
Yeah. I think one of the ways to think about the early history of chemistry is to say the history of chemistry isn't just what people figured out about elements. It's not how we got from four elements or three elements to the periodic table. The history of science, of the history of early chemistry, is the history of people who tried to heat stuff up in order to figure out what it was, And so if you say, okay, where was that activity happening? How were people going about this work? What did they think the results that they discovered were? And what did they do with those results? Because a lot of people weren't interested in publishing. I mean, for us in the academic world, it's really hard to imagine that people didn't want to publish everything. But a lot of people were personally satisfied with their own understanding. They thought, this is great. I know it. I'll write it to a couple of friends. I'll make a little manuscript of my notes and I'll give it to the king. job done. And for us, we have really treated particularly large format, beautiful scientific books, frequently written in Latin, as a kind of gold standard for what science looks like in the 16th and 17th centuries. What I tend to work with are manuscripts written in the vernacular, mostly in Spanish, other sermons, other kinds of things.
Maybe letters.
Right, exactly. Correspondence and all sorts of, if you look at the legislation, what does the legislation say about the social control of these activities?
Mm-hmm. You also mentioned Inquisition records,
right,
which people might not have thought of a place to go to look at science.
Oh my
science.
Gosh, yeah. Inquisition records are really incredible. But because people have to give their whole life history and they say things like, what were the titles of the books that you held? And the woman
would
say,
supposed to have.
And the woman would say, these are the titles of the books that I had. And they say, what would you use them for? And she would say, nothing. I don't know how to read. and then usually the problem with the Inquisition, and the Inquisition is actually a good comparison to what I've sort of the conclusion I've come to about the history of science. People for about 60 years have been publishing about how the Inquisition actually worked. How was torture done? How long did it last? How many times could it be done? Who was picked up by the Inquisition? What were the results of inquisitorial trials? You know, people have, for a long time have said, yeah, the Inquisition was mostly a bunch of functionaries of the government who didn't like their jobs that much and who tried to duck out of work whenever they could. And it was, as a surveillance apparatus, not particularly sophisticated. And people have been publishing that for 60 years. And that hasn't changed very many minds. You know, I mean, we still need the Inquisition to be a way to talk about the overreach of government and the kinds of torture and fear that a government can inspire. And I think partly because we don't want to think about the fact that we live in a society that has a really incredible surveillance apparatus, in a society that has tortured its own citizens and certainly the citizens of other nations. You know, I mean, the society in which my tax dollars went to, you know, the targeted assassination of U.S. citizens. So,
right.
So
that's,
I think,
very much on our mind. The Inquisition is very much on our mind as a model.
Right, yeah. And so the idea that, hey, you know, the Inquisition had a lot of rules. The rules were mostly followed. And that, yes, they did include things like torture. I think that we have been publishing on that, people in my discipline, for 60 years, and we have not arrived at the conclusion of, yeah, and that's still better than the mass incarceration of people by race, right? Like, I mean, it still needs to, which is the society that I pay for now with my tax dollars, you know, and I still think that we have not really wrestled with what the Inquisition means. And so what do you do when you work at something for half a century and you say, the results are pretty skimpy? You know, do you keep trying to propose? And the same thing happens with the history of science, although I think the stakes are somewhat lower. Do you keep saying, no, there's another story to be told? A friend of mine wrote an article that had the title Iberian Science in the Renaissance Ignored How Much Longer, right? And the answer is sort of like forever.
Yeah. So you're going to change it because you may have looked at the seven beautiful publication books that are held up as the gold standard of science, but you still have, there's a lot of other things that you haven't looked at yet. So you're going to do that. I just want to clarify for our listeners, you are not arguing for the reintroduction of the Inquisition.
No.
Per se.
No.
I just wasn't quite sure what you were saying when you say the Inquisition worked. What do you mean?
No, that the rules were mostly obeyed. That there were rules that the inquisitors had to obey, and they were, those rules for the most part seem to have been largely respected.
Mm-hmm.
Now those rules did include things like the ability to torture people,
right,
and it was really horrific. At mm-hmm. the same time, we know what those rules feel like today. We
mm-hmm.
know that you know, I'm a white man and I don't have to fear the arbitrariness of the state. Whereas you know, my cousin who is African American does, mm-hmm, right? Like, mm-hmm. Those kinds of things to me are obscured when we use something like the Inquisition to say, weren't things terrible in the past?
Right.
Weren't people horrible in the past when they did stuff
unlike us?
Unlike us.
Exactly.
Aren't we? Mm-hmm. Great.
But, well, and one of the other points you're making, which I think is also extremely interesting, is that in the process of doing the Inquisition, they recorded a whole lot of stuff. There's just an amazing amount of stuff gets put down that we would not have access to. And certainly that, and then we go through it all and we try to sort out all of this material. So what then have you learned after having, I think, thought very profoundly about a question which I think faces many of us, including many of our listeners, which is, if the discourse doesn't seem to include you or the people you study, mm-hmm, what do you do? One thing is to try to add them into the discourse. The other one is to try to just change the discourse. And right. I imagine that many of us today are in situations where we would like to have some kind of change in the
right.
discourse. So,
yeah.
So what do you have to guide us then in terms of, to me, this seems to be part of the question of the value of the study of the humanities, that it gives us ways to ask these, which is a fairly broad question here.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I think that in my own case, the answer has been, stop spending so much energy trying to convince other people about the sort of nature of the argument. Hmm. Just do the history. Just trust that the history is going to win. So if that means looking at other kinds of source materials, studying other kinds of human lives, broadening what it means to do science, those are the things that I've chosen to do rather than to say, we have traditionally told the history of science in a particular ways, and I suggest that we do it somewhat differently, right? You can spend a lot of time on these sort of meta historiographic, mm-hmm, reflections that I don't think ultimately, or I haven't seen them carry the day, when it comes to the history of Spanish science. So, part of me says, yeah, just do the work, you know. I mean, don't worry about the argument. Don't worry about these sort of larger disciplinary concerns. Just write the histories of the human beings that you see represented in the books and archives that you work with.
Using the sources. I mean, it's funny because it's sort of to me like you're kind of troping off the history of alchemy itself. You're kind of saying that, you know, instead of trying to get this guy to slightly change what he's doing by taking his discourse and saying, no, you have to heat it up faster here or a little bit slower here. It's saying, like, just do your new thing. Bring in your new thing. Bring in your
right.
new sources. Change the idea. So is there any limit then in your mind? People often ask me about religion, you know, doesn't religion include science? I say, well, if religion included all of science, my department would be much bigger at Davis.
Right, yeah.
You know, we'd have much better funding than
yeah.
we do now at the Davis that we have today. So what do you see then? What are the limits of what the history of science then includes? I mean, if you have this, if you're going to be using all these new sources, is science going to be everything we do in a certain way in the 17th century?
I mean, I think that the contours of it will always probably be more narrow than the way that we construe STEM now. I do think that it will be hard to get away from a history of science that's not tied to the way that the disciplines sorted themselves out. So sort of life sciences and applied sciences and those sorts of things. I think that it will probably look like that because you don't want your reader to have to swallow an entire new organization of knowledge in order to read your article about sermons, you know what I mean? So I think that alchemy, you know, will probably always be a part of the history of chemistry. I think that what people were doing with plants, which they usually thought of as natural history, will always be a part of the history of botany. There are some other things that are more complicated that have to do with nutrition and what people were eating and those kinds of things. That, yeah, I mean, would we call that science? Well, it's not exactly, there isn't a kind of a continuous A to B line to draw between mm-hmm. what they were doing then and what we do now.
Well, that's kind of reassuring to me because I don't want everything to turn into religion either, right?
Yeah.
So I want to thank John Slater very much for coming today. And you can this show will be archived on officehourucdpodcast.com, and there'll be a link to your website if people want to read about alchemy. Maybe
Super.
They want to get out their little tools and start to heat up things and see if they can make gold.
Yeah, a lot of people end up with a bad headache
yeah.
from doing it. So.
Okay, so warning.
Yeah.
Alchemical endeavors come
and
with a warning.
Mercury poisoning.
Right. So you can listen to that. I want to thank you very much for coming on the show today.
Thank you very much. It's really been a treat to talk with you.
Yeah, and I want to thank Jocelyn and Benjamin for their donations to the show and remind everybody this is Pledge Week. So this is your big chance to get in on the conversation and call. And the number, just to remind everybody, 530-754-KDVS. And I hope that during break some of you call because somebody's got to pay for the electricity. So if we're going to talk alchemy, we need someone to give us the bucks to keep the lights on. So, and we'll be back next week. So thanks very much.
Thank
thanks, John.
You bet. Thank you.